time, as our saying goes, marches on. But for the majority of people, across the majority of human history, time has been viewed as circular, an uninterrupted cycle of birth and death. There is no arrow of time, but rather a boomerang. Many cosmologies and civilizations as diverse as the Mayans, the Babylonians, Hindus, and Jains have had a concept of a wheel of time that spins around endlessly. This past week, as I've seen the leaves starting to change color, earlier in the calendar than I remember, but that's neither here nor there, I've been struck by the intuitiveness of thinking of time as cyclical. True, the leaves are dying, the days are getting shorter, the temperatures are dropping, but everything will come back around. The leaves will return, the days will get shorter until they start getting longer, the temperatures will drop until they start to rise again, and so on and so on. It's worth pointing out that the Earth is, in fact, moving around in circles around the sun. Apologies to any physicists. I'm aware that the Earth's orbit is actually elliptical, but the metaphor still holds. So, given that so many of the natural phenomena that we observe are cyclical, it's very easy to see why the idea of reincarnation appears in so many belief systems. In nature, life and death are not opposite ends of a spectrum, but different stages in a cycle. Even in our very linear modern world, where our days and years move ineluctably and irreversibly from one number in a sequence to the next, our lives are in large part governed by repeating cycles of our own creation. For many, it's the academic calendar. For some, maybe the church calendar. In finance, there's quarterly reporting cycles. These repeating patterns and cycles in many ways help keep the rhythm of our lives. It's a fairly easy step from viewing time as an inescapable repeating cycle to thinking of history and human relations as an inescapable repeating cycle. And in fact, this was how much of the ancient Mediterranean world thought of history. There was an early Greek philosopher called Empedocles who conceptualized a cosmic cycle governed by elements he called love and strife, somewhat similar to yin and yang in Chinese cosmology. The sphere of existence, according to Empedocles, was constantly being pulled back and forth between love and strife, with neither able to overcome the other. Plato and Aristotle both seemed to share the belief that human society would be wrecked and rehabilitated repeatedly, with Plato hypothesizing that the gods would always intervene at the 11th hour, restore order to the cosmos, and then leave it to its own devices until it was back to the brink of disaster, and the gods would intervene again, and the cycle would start all over. It's not just the ancients who were seduced by the idea of human history as a repeating cycle. In the 19th and 20th centuries, theorists from a number of disciplines, including economists, historians, mathematicians, and sociologists, developed social cycle theories, and some even went as far to assert that it should be possible to predict with some precision future historical events, such as economic depression or political turmoil, as all cultures and civilizations pass through the same cycles. In political science, long cycle theory posited that massive destabilizing events, such as war, are simply the product of a movement of a system at regular intervals through these long cycles. It's not just at the level of international relations that this view of inescapable cycles is prevalent. Sometimes the inability of families or communities to break the cycle of poverty or break the cycle of abuse is cynically attributed not to particular material circumstances or historic conditions, but to human nature, as if human behavior was as fixed and immutable as the movement of the planets or the passage of the seasons. In a book called The Gift of the Jew, scholar Thomas Cahill suggests that the dramatic development within the Old Testament, what set the ancient Israelites apart from other peoples in the ancient Mediterranean, was the conception of a linear time with a teleology. Time had a beginning, and it would have a triumphant conclusion, which would come in the future. Humans were not just moving around in an endless cycle, but were moving towards something, progressing. They weren't just wandering around in circles in the desert, but they were moving towards something. Okay. This lengthy postulating on the linearity or cyclicality of time was all just a prologue, so let's get to today's passage. A parable of Jesus, sometimes called the parable of the unmerciful servant or the parable of the unforgiving servant. What's both wonderful and frustrating about parables, but ultimately wonderful, is that they aren't straightforward, bullet-pointed teachings with clear and absolute principles that make perfect sense in the abstract but are difficult to apply to the messiness of reality. They're stories. And stories, like real life, aren't always unambiguous in the lessons they offer. One potential theological implication of today's parable is that God's mercy and forgiveness is contingent and dependent on human forgiveness. This parable could be the springboard for a theological debate, but frankly, I'm not so interested in having that. Instead, I think it's helpful to try to understand the dynamics in this parable as its first hearers might have understood them. Although the translation we read today called the principal character in the story a slave of the king, a better translation would probably be servant, and the dynamic here is a patron-client relationship, which was part and parcel of the first century Mediterranean world. Patrons maintain loyalty by granting favors, but on the condition that the client would repay their patron whenever and however the patron decided. Because this debt was a form of power, it wasn't uncommon for patrons to have mercy and forgive the debts of a client if the client demonstrated their loyalty, as the servant does in this parable by falling on his knees before the king. Rulers often thought that such acts of compassion would increase their honorable reputation, which was crucial to maintaining power and prestige in an honor-based culture. And in fact, general cancellation of debts was an established royal practice in the ancient world, documented as far back as ancient Sumer in 2500 BC. It was common in many dynasties for a new ruler, upon taking the throne, to start their reign by canceling all debts within the realm. You've probably heard of the Rosetta Stone, but you may not know that its famous text contains an announcement in three different languages of an amnesty for debtors decreed by Ptolemy V in 196 BC. The expectation in these debt cancellation events was that everyone who had had their royal debts forgiven would then reciprocate, such that there would be a nationwide forgiveness of debts. Now, these clean slates were necessary for the preservation of civilizations because even though debt did serve some useful purposes, it unleashed a vicious cycle of exploitation and bondage that could bring down entire societies. In Sparta, in the 3rd century BC, for example, the ranks of the Spartan army were so depleted because too much of the citizenry had lost their land tenure and were bond servants to creditors. In today's parable, we have a hint of the dynamics at play. Everyone except the king at the very top is caught in a cycle of ruthlessness. The servant can't be the one to initiate the cleaning of slates because if he forgives the debt that's owed to him, he won't be able to pay the debt that he owes the king, and the consequences for defaulting, as we see, are quite serious. We can think of this as a sort of trickle-down ruthlessness. So debt cancellation was a sort of reset button, and no doubt the king in this story would assume that his cancellation of his servant's debt should set in motion a cascade of debt forgiveness. With this high-level servant relieved of his obligation to repay the king, he now would not need to collect the debts that the lower-level servants owed him. But the unmerciful servant in the story doesn't pay it forward. He doesn't break the cycle. And when the king learns of this, he reverses course and has the unmerciful servant punished until he can repay the original debt. This is the part of the story that would have surprised its original audience, as the king reneging on his earlier debt forgiveness might cause him to forfeit the honorable reputation his earlier magnanimity would have garnered. Admittedly, the king's behavior in the story does seem somewhat hypocritical, but again, this is a parable, and parables are sometimes a bit murky. We know from modern history that debt cancellation is an important element in disrupting the cycle of war and violence. For example, in Europe, after World War I, the victorious Allies insisted on making the defeated Germans pay a war debt, which created the economic hardship and resentment that ultimately gave rise to Adolf Hitler. After World War II, though, the Allies canceled all German debts, except for debts owed by employers to the employees. And this cleaning of the slates was in turn the basis for Germany's post-war economic miracle. The current pandemic we're living through has hit the pause button on many of the patterns and cycles that governed our life up until March 2020. I hope it's offered us a chance to think about whether we'll return to our normal routines, fall back into the same patterns as before, or whether we can advance. I think we're all aware that we're living through history, but we need not be trapped in history. I'd invite any reflections during the sharing time, of course, but maybe during the responses and sharing and in the coming weeks, you could think about and suggest ways you see to disrupt the patterns and cycles we might have been caught in, whether at the individual, community, national, international level. Think about and share, if you feel comfortable, how we might take advantage of this opportunity to move forward rather than just return to moving around. Thank you.